from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up later on the Forum program, we'll talk about the departure of Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen. What will it mean for President Trump's immigration policy? But first, the president's tax reform law went into effect on January 1st, and it introduced a number of major changes that could affect your 2018 return, which is due in a week. To help you prepare, we've brought in some experts to field your last-minute questions, from the exemptions and itemized deductions you can still claim to the status of the alternative minimum tax, and we'll take all your questions. That's next, after the news. Welcome to this morning's Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act went into effect on the 1st of January, and it imposes a host of new rules governing federal tax rates, deductions, and credits. The April 15th deadline to file your 2018 taxes is just a week away. So in this hour of Forum, we're going to open our phone line so you can ask our panel of experts all your federal and state income tax questions. And let me give you the number now. I know there will be many of you who have questions, and it's an excellent opportunity to get those questions answered, whether they're about your business or about you individually. The number to call toll-free is 866-733-6786. That number once more is 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions you might have to forum@kqed.org. Joining us is Rafael Tolino. He is spokesperson for the IRS for both California and Nevada. And welcome to the program. Good to have you with us.
Hi, Mr. Krasny. Thank you so much for having me this morning.
Glad to have you, and also glad to have here in studio Aubrey Hone, who's a partner in Hone Maxwell LLP. They're a tax law firm with offices in both San Francisco and San Diego, and welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Robert Kaplan with us, partner with Kaplan & Wong CPAs LLP in San Mateo, and a member of the American Institute of CPAs Individual Tax Committee. Welcome, Robert Kaplan.
Thank you very much.
So we have an exceptional committee here with us, and you indeed have questions. The phone lines are buzzing, as I might have expected. And let me begin by going to Rafael Tolino. And let's begin by just asking, contrary to what many assumed in the Republican side of things, you're not going to be able to do your taxes with a postcard this year, are you, Rafael Tolino?
Well, most people are going to actually use a computer. E-file is definitely the way everybody's doing it, about 90-95% of all returns, paperless, and choosing direct deposit. But certainly the software holds your hand, and your tax professional, who a lot of people use, knows all the news, ins and outs, and the laws and everything that's there. So the things have changed, though. I will tell you, Mr. Krasny, the 1040 form is different. There are six new schedules. The 1040A and the 1040EZ are now gone or suspended per this new law. So things do fundamentally look a lot different on a 1040 form, no question about it.
One thing that has stayed somewhat the same, there were IRS statistics that were released recently that suggest that the share of taxpayers receiving refunds and the size of their checks are roughly in line with what they were at the same time last year.
Right, and it's important to take to think about it. The taxes you pay and the refund you receive are two different things, and certainly a lot of folks saw a little bit of something different, unexpected surprise. So we've been saying, take a look, do some tax planning, definitely considering the enormity of the law and how it affects everybody in all in one way, shape, or form. So not a bad idea to do some tax planning and bring the taxes you pay closer to what you owe. But yes, going back to what your question is saying, things have leveled off and things look pretty much the same as they have in years past. It's just individually things have changed for us because we are using some new laws here that we haven't seen in a while. So there is an effect, no question about it.
Talking to Rafael Tolino, who is spokesperson for the IRS for California and Nevada. And let me say that the IRS still doesn't pay interest to people who overpay, that is, who have more money withheld from their paychecks or who make larger estimated tax payments than what they actually owe. And there have been taxpayers complaining over the years about, well, I suppose what's called asymmetry here. The IRS does charge interest to underpayers, right?
This is true, and you do not have to get a refund. You should do what you can to bring the taxes you pay closer to what you actually will pay based on things. And we have a tool called a withholding calculator on IRS.gov to help you do that. But that is right. You do not have to do that. And if you are too far under withheld, there's some penalty relief we've announced in the last couple of months for that. based on and what we're hearing from the new law and how it's affecting taxpayers. But, you know, certainly there is a lot of money that goes back to taxpayers or over withheld. You don't have to do that. And certainly not a bad idea to do some tax planning, especially in light of the new law.
Well, let's talk about the new law. And let me go to you on this, Aubrey Hone. There are people who are benefiting other than billionaires. Who are they?
So there's a lot of people who are benefiting in part from the larger standard deduction. So people who were claiming the standard deduction in the past or who had a lower itemized deduction, the standard deduction nearly doubled in the under tax reform. So that's been a benefit to people. The larger child tax credit has been a benefit, and there's a higher income phase out for that. So that's also been beneficial to a number of taxpayers.
Child care tax credit has doubled, actually, hasn't it? Just about?
Correct.
Yes.
Okay.
And the income threshold, Aubrey, sorry to interrupt you, I think is 400,000 married filing joint where it begins to phase out. So a lot more people will get this credit for having under age 17. Yeah.
Yeah. It used to be 110,000. So right. It's increased significantly.
Considerable increase. Could you say something, Rafael Tolino, about the advantages or disadvantages of red states and blue states, especially here in California?
Well, we're a neutral agency, okay? So I want to make sure
I understand
but I understand your question, of course. You could, for example, the state and local tax cap of $10,000 on your Schedule A, I would argue that it's probably having a bigger effect out here in California than other parts of the country, for example, because we don't we itemize a little more here in general, and you're going to see a lot of folks not being able to take the full amount of that deduction based on new law. So that by itself is certainly affecting folks out here more than in anything else, at least what I've heard from friends and family and those kinds of things.
What would you want, Robert Kaplan, people to be particularly apprised of, friends, family, and businesses?
I think that everybody has a different situation. It's almost impossible to eyeball this thing and say, oh, I'm going to do better under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act than I was under the prior law. You have to run the numbers. For example, in 2017, a lot of people were subject to alternative minimum tax here in California. They couldn't deduct their state income taxes and miscellaneous itemized deductions. And as you said, the SALT deduction went down to $10,000, and miscellaneous itemized deductions are generally gone. So you would think those people would pay more tax, but some of them pay less. There's also, I'm sure we're going to talk about the qualified business income deduction, which is a long story.
Can you make it a cogent story for us, at least in terms of the highlights of it?
Well, if you're not a wage earner and not a C corporation, you're what's called a flow-through business, which is an S corp, a partnership, a Schedule C, which is a sole proprietor, a farm, or a rental. You may be entitled to up to 20% of your net income as a deduction on your federal return. So it's a major deduction.
And again, if you have questions, please bring them to the fore here. We'll go to your calls forthwith. The number to call is 866-733-6786, or you can email us forum@kqed.org. And here's a question. Let me go to you on this, Aubrey Hone, from a listener named Alan, Gerald, who says, can you help people understand the difference between a rate and a marginal rate? I see the two confused constantly.
Yeah, so our rates are essentially a ladder, right? So you have a certain amount of income is subject to one rate, and you're moving up a ladder. So there's an effective rate, which is a blending of all of those rates and kind of the blended number on your total taxable income. And then there's your marginal rate, which is essentially the top rate that you top out at. So there's rates, which is all of the rates. There's your marginal rate, which is your top rate. And then there's an effective rate.
All right, let me go right to our callers. Lots of questions from callers. We'll get to as many of you as we can, and we'll begin, Ray, with you. You're on the air. Good morning, Ray.
Hi there. I have a bad debt from a friend who I've tried to collect. I understand if I've made a reasonable effort that I could write off this debt. And where do I do that on the form? I do itemize.
Robert Kaplan?
Well, you have to have evidence that it's a bad debt. You have to have documentation that it's a debt. You have to have the documentation that it's a bad debt, and the best documentation of that is bankruptcy. Assuming you have the proper documentation, it's a capital loss because you're not in the trade or business of making loans.
It brings up another question. I want to go to you on this, Rafael Tolino. There are people who have bad debts, and they want the IRS to know about them. Can you address that?
If you get relief from debt, that can't be taxable unless it's your home. And we had a law that came along that kind of helps that out if you go into foreclosure, that kind of thing. But unfortunately, there are some taxable consequences there. And as Mr. Kaplan said, if it veers into insolvency and or bankruptcy, then that's a whole new different set of rules, to be quite honest.
Here's Alan who says, and to you on this, Aubrey Hone, just finished my taxes using TurboTax services. Do I really need to print and save all those 150 to 250 pages, wasting all the paper and ink? Won't TurboTax have it for me if I need it?
A lot of people have trouble finding their, I would suggest save a PDF. So don't go ahead and print it, but save a PDF somewhere. You may need it. You may need all those schedules and worksheets if you work with a professional in the future. I would not rely on TurboTax pulling it up for you in the future.
And more of your calls. Vincent joins us next. Vincent, welcome. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, just my comment as someone actually that did my taxes just recently and looked like in comparing to last year that I did a little bit better tax-wise now, even though I itemized before and now I didn't because of the standard deduction increasing. But I did notice that obviously none of my charitable contributions account anymore towards the deduction, and I'm not sure if I'll make those again this year. I'm trying to think about it. What do the experts think about how that the fact that the charitable donations won't be there going forward is going to be may have an impact on some of those charities?
Yeah, Robert Kaplan.
Yeah, I'm seeing that certainly people with a standard deduction get no benefit out of a charitable deduction unless they're over age 70 and a half and they can take a qualified charitable distribution. And I'm curious what the statistics will show, whether charitable contributions are going down as a result of that.
Yeah, that should be very revealing indeed. And let me thank you for the call. Good to hear from you, Vincent. Here's Judith. And let me go back to you, if I may, Mr. Tolino. Rafael Tolino, again, is spokesperson for the IRS for California and Nevada. Judith wants to know, how are people who do not have access to computers, and you had mentioned most people doing filing by computer, supposed to prepare their returns? The forms are too complicated.
Yeah, I understand that. I get it. I completely understand it. Things have changed a little bit. You could argue it's more simple. But then again, the 1040 form is like a half a page, but then there's six schedules that accompany it now. But if you're going to use paper and pencil, you're definitely in the minority. You might want to try to get some help. We have free tax help and out in the community, volunteer income tax assistance, that kind of thing. But I understand. I get it. I wish I had an answer for her to say, hey, this is going to be simple. It is simpler in some forms, and that's what software does for you. But I understand. I get it. I really do.
Well, we'll get some more calls on here. We'll go next to Demetrius and Milbrae. Good morning.
Yes, hi. Good morning. I had a business that I closed about 3 years ago, and also I have many, a few decades worth of personal taxes. I'm wondering how long do I need to keep my records, business or personal, for potential audits down the road?
Aubrey Hone.
So generally, you'll want to keep your records for at least 7 years. And then for records for things such as if you have a net operating loss or for documentation related to real estate that you own, you'll want to continue to keep those records until the loss is used or until you sell the home. But generally, the rule of thumb is 7 years.
And I was going to say one thing. You might want to keep the 1040 form itself for longer than that. It's just the actual 1040 for records. But depends on things, but that's something I always mention to folks. You might not, that 1040 itself is worth keeping.
Okay, thank you. Good advice, wise advice, and we'll get more calls. Lots of questions coming through here. Here's Al. Al, sounds like you have a bit of a problem here, right?
Yes. Hi, good morning. Got a quick question. I owe about 4 years of the taxes. 2006 and 2007, I was audited. And I did not pay, and I tried to negotiate it, but nothing happened. And also 2011 and 2012 are just like unpaid as well, too. Is there any tax law saying, like, if the tax is not collected for 10 years, I can wash it out?
We'll go again to you here, Rafael Tolino.
Well, there's a statute of 10 years, but depending on the situation you're in, if you're not, paying taxes and the IRS will usually send you a letter and try to reach out to you to try to settle your obligation there. But I'm not aware of anything that'll make it just kind of go away. Depends on the situation and your unique set of facts and circumstances based on what you owe and all the years you mentioned, that kind of thing. But that 10-year statute is there, but I'm not sure how it's going to apply to you directly.
Well, good luck to you, Al, and thank you for the... Anybody want to add anything, Robert Kaplan?
I just want to mention that there's a 10-year statute for federal. There's a 20-year statute for California. So depending on whether it's federal or state, and then it also depends on when the tax was assessed. So there's a lot of factors there.
Okay.
If there's willful evasion, that kind of a thing where it veers into the criminal side of things, then that 10-year, there really isn't a statute. You know what I mean? So... depending on things.
That's in a class by itself.
Yeah, that's a different kind of set of rules there for folks.
And again, we're taking your questions, any income tax questions you may have. We have Aubrey Hone with us in studio, partner of Hone Maxwell LLP, and Robert Kaplan, partner of Kaplan and Wong CPAs. And we also have Rafael Tolino with us, who's a spokesperson for the IRS for California and Nevada. And if you have questions, we welcome them. Here's Philip, who says, the biggest surprise I got from my tax preparer is that starting in 2019, the business meal expenses I incur are not deductible unless that meal is experienced more than 50 miles away. In other words, while traveling. This is pretty tough for Bay Area businesses that do dine out locally. Want to say anything on that, Rafael Tolino?
Yeah, there's been some changes for sure in terms of meals and entertainment expenses, and they're all laid out in a publication I'll offer, publication 463. But no question, things have been modified in terms of what you can do in terms of entertainment and business expenses per this new law. No question about it.
And Jim writes, let me go to you on this, Aubrey Hone, again. What does box 11 mean on the 1040 form? On the past easy form, it would state enter the amount in box 1. This line just says tax, qualified business tax.
So tax is the it's the calculation of the tax owed. So there's qualified business income, which is on a different line, then your taxable income's on line 10, and then 11 is just the calculation of the tax owed, and then there's other taxes. You know, it's not your total tax. Again, it's not quite that simple. So that's just the calculation of the basic tax, and then there's other taxes added below that, and you have to get to line 15 to see your total tax due.
Let me go to some more of your calls, and we'll go next to Berkeley. Bob, you're on the air.
Hello. I found that in declare, I almost always itemize, and I found that the effects on my donations are dramatically different. Used to be I could contribute up to 30% in appreciated capital gains deduction for donations, and then I could add another 20% in cash or make a total of 50% of my adjusted gross income deductions through donations. Now, when I read it, it seems to imply that the limitation on my donation in cash is 30%, and it used to be 50%. How can I get my numbers back up to 50%, or how can I work around this? Thank you.
All right. Well, those deduction rules have changed dramatically. Robert Kaplan, let's hear from you.
It's actually better than you think. The maximum amount for cash contributions went from 50% to 60% of your adjusted gross income, so that's good news. The capital gains type donation, which includes stuff that you give the Goodwill Salvation Army, as well as appreciated stock, that kind of thing, is still at 30% of your adjusted gross income. Any excess is carried over for up to 5 years.
And I want to just add something, Rafael Tolino?
Yeah, I was just going to say, based on Vincent's call, too, I was reading some stories where a lot of folks are considering, based on the change, of bunching charitable contributions, in other words, making them every other year, where it might be able to be a benefit for you to get to that Schedule A. You know what I mean? So that's something I've read about, maybe some planning idea there.
There's a caller named Harsh from Sunnyvale joining us. Good morning.
Hi. I lost some money in an escrow because of a property I decided not to buy. Can I claim that as a capital loss, and where do I do that?
We'll ask our two tax experts here in studio, Robert Kaplan.
I think I had that once, and unfortunately you never bought the asset. So I think that's goes into the miscellaneous itemized deductions, which are no longer deductible. That's my estimation of that.
May not be the answer you wanted, Harsh, but thank you for the question. Here's Willis says, again, TurboTax tells me every year that I'm not charging market rent for my rental. Every year, the disparity gets worse because I don't raise the rent. Is my generosity eventually going to trigger an IRS audit, Rafael Tolino?
Depends on the complete set of facts and circumstances around it. I couldn't tell you one way or another, but it's a nice position to be in for the person who's... taking the rent there, but I really couldn't tell you, to be honest.
Yeah, it's a nice way to put it, too. Yep. Any thoughts from either of our in-studio tax experts here?
Well, technically, there's a rule that if you rent a property at below market, that you can only deduct expenses up to the amount of the rent, and you can't take a loss beyond that. So technically, there is a rule that limits the amount of deductions you can take against the rent. But again, it's, you know, just because TurboTax says it's below market, you would need to have more information.
Exactly.
And here's a specific question from Alan who wants to know, what kind of documentation do I need to take when relocating to another state? I'm trying to keep my pension from being taxed in California. Is there a time frame in which to do this?
Well, we actually have a checklist of 20 items that you need to verify in order to really consider that you moved out of the state, not just moving your stuff. Such things as the homeowner's exemption, which is a small amount off your property tax, voter's registration, DMV, all that kind of stuff. And that list is very important to really document that you moved out of the state. The Franchise Tax Board is extremely aggressive in auditing people that have a connection to California and say they moved.
It's a big job unto itself, really, isn't it?
Yes.
And we'll get some more of your calls on. Let me go next to Liz. Liz, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I've already done my taxes, and I'm afraid that they might have done them incorrectly. Last fall, I was really nervous before the election, so I put stop loss at 20% on some stocks that I had held for a long time. For example, 100 shares of Amazon were purchased for $597, but then they were worth $160,000. So I had a capital gains of about $243,000 because my tech stocks really rose.
You're making things sound more enviable by the moment here. But
I love the stock market. So I paid in January, before January 15th, I made a payment to the federal government of $47,000. I had my taxes done in March, and she told me I owed $22,000 to California, but I got a refund of $7,000 from the federal government. So more or less, I paid about $60,000 on $243,000 long-term capital gains, all right? The money was reinvested. I didn't take any money out except to pay taxes.
Liz, we're coming up on a break here. All these details are fascinating, but let me cut to the chase here, and we'll go again to you, Rafael Tolino. If you make a mistake, what can be done? How to rectify it?
It depends on
and
what
it is. And is it a mistake, I guess?
Well, if it's a math error, the IRS will probably do it for you. But if you omit something or if there's something bigger than that, then you might have to file an amended return. The IRS may send you a letter asking you about it, then you can just respond to that letter and take care of business that way.
And she wants to know the best way to do that?
To file a 1040-X, an amended return?
Was it done wrong, I think, is what she wants to know. At least I can't
know until you know more about it.
Yeah.
If it is, then let's take care of it. We'll work it out with you. The IRS will, at least, depending on what you got.
Okay, that's straight from the IRS. And we'll hear more of your questions and try to provide answers for you. Feel free to join us at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. Your income tax questions are welcome, and we hope will be answered. And you can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. I'm Michael Krasny. That's a lyric many people can relate to. We're talking about taxes as filing is coming up ahead in about a week, and we have experts here. We've got kind of a clinic answering any questions and concerns you might have, whether they're related to you individually or to the business you're involved in. And with us here in studio is Robert Kaplan, a partner in Kaplan & Wong CPAs, LLP in San Mateo. He's a member of the American Institute of CPAs Individual Tax Committee. And Aubrey Hone is a partner in Hone Maxwell LLP, a tax law firm with offices in San Francisco and San Diego. And Rafael Tolino is with us as well, spokesperson for the IRS for California and Nevada. And we're trying to get all your questions answered. couple of specific questions for our in-studio experts here. Greg writes, for 2018, I have already contributed the max to my 401k and to my personal IRA. What, if anything, may I contribute to my SEP IRA?
You have to have self-employment income in order to contribute to a SEP IRA, and it's a calculation based on the self-employment, the net self-employment income with some adjustments for self-employment tax. So I couldn't tell you exactly what you could what you can contribute, but there's lots of calculators online. A SEP IRA is a better option than a traditional IRA as far as deductions and savings go.
Another IRA question, Robert Kaplan. Key writes, are we still able to make 2018 contributions to an IRA?
Yeah, up until next Monday, a week from today.
Okay. It's probably good news. And here's Mara, who writes, I started working as a, and let me go to either one of you on this. I started working as a self-employed consultant last year and haven't yet established either an LLC, S Corp, or any official business entity. It will be a sole proprietorship once I do so. You just mentioned the flow-through deduction for businesses. If I haven't yet officially established the business through the state, can I still take this deduction? And how do I find it on TurboTax?
Well, yes, as I said, a Schedule C, which is a sole proprietor, qualifies for potentially the qualified business income deduction. And basically, based on your net income and the kind of business you have, and a very exciting math computation, you can calculate basically up to a 20% deduction. I'm not familiar with TurboTax, so I don't know how that works.
I think most of that's outlined on the website. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Let's go to more of your calls, and let's go to Donald next. Donald, join us. You're on the air.
Make America great again. This question's for Raphael. What happens when somebody uses an ID, a fraudulent ID, and commits ID fraud, saying that they're paying their taxes, being an illegal immigrant? Where does that money go, and does the IRS verify identity and keep the money and clear it up, or how does that work?
Well, if the taxes you pay and the IRS are, you know, if you have a – I'm not sure how to answer that because it veers into something I really don't want to cross in terms of the politics of it. But we administer the tax laws there, and we'll take care of that. In terms of sharing information, we don't do that. Unless it's an extreme circumstance, so I'm not sure how to play that one out. If you want, give me one more chance. Repeat what you just said in terms of
How do you let's say you have an illegal immigrant in the country for 20 years who says, "Hey, I've been paying my taxes, I'm a good citizen." How do you?
How do you confirm
match
that?
Match it up if it's fraudulent.
Yeah. I'm not so sure what you mean if it's fraudulent. See, if you're in this country, you get a Social Security number or something called an ITIN, ITIN. If you have a tax purpose, you file with one or the other. If you have a requirement to file, and so we administer that through, you know, with taxes and through the laws that we administer for tax and enforce, of course. But I don't know what to tell you just in terms of answering that without knowing more, and it's probably not something we should do live on the radio here.
Yeah, I think we maybe need more information, Donald, but thank you for the call, and we'll get right into another call here, and that's Chris from Atherton. Chris, you're on.
Hi there. Yeah, I'm a PhD student. My stipend is paid by my department. It's not earned income. I don't have a W-2 or 1099. We have an email thread every year about, like, how do we pay our taxes? Where do we report our income? And no one really knows. So, like, we have a 1098-T, but that documents tuition, not income. And I'm also told, like, I don't have to pay Medicare and Social Security taxes because I'm a student. So how do I report this?
Either of our guests in the studio, Aubrey, want to answer?
So generally, you would report your stipend as other income, which then would not be subject to self-employment tax, which is Social Security and Medicare, but it would be subject to ordinary income tax. So you would report it as other income, which used to be line 21. I don't know what line it is anymore on the 1040.
Yep. You got the 1040 right here in studio.
Line 21 is a catch-all.
Yeah, line 21 is a catch-all. It's line 21 of Schedule 1 nowadays.
Yep. Good luck with that, Chris. Thank you for your call. Here's a listener who writes, is it true that foreign tax relief on the federal tax related to tax treaties do not apply for California taxes? If so, how is this legal? Robert Kaplan.
Yeah, there's foreign tax treaties with a variety of different countries, and they're basic gist of them is that you pay tax in the country of residence. So, for example, if you're living in, say, South Korea, and your wages are in South Korea, you'd pay taxes to South Korea, but you'd pay U.S. tax on all U.S. source income. But each tax treaty is different, and you have to review it to know how to handle it.
Let me go to more of your calls, and let's go next to a caller in San Diego. Sarah, join us. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling because for the first time ever, I owe taxes to the IRS. I owe $1,760 because of a severance that I received after being laid off from my job in October. And I need to set up a payment plan. Well, first I'm wondering, I mean, I'm using Tax Act. So it's, I mean, I'm paying for that online. I've always filed electronically with them, state and federal. But I guess one of my questions is, how do I set up a payment plan? Because I've always worked with nonprofits. I'm still 6 months out after being laid off, looking for work. So how does one set up a payment plan, and how do I check the numbers to make sure that that's accurate?
Yeah, and I think Mr. Tolino can probably answer that. Rafael,
the payment plan is on IRS.gov. It's an online payment agreement, and with your amount owed, you can easily set that up online and pay over time. If you can short-term payment in 120 days or less, then you might avoid some of the interest that you may have to pay and the extra on top. For stretching that out. But certainly if you have a requirement to file, you want to file the return, at least pay something and move forward from there.
Good luck with that, Sarah. Thank you for your question, and good luck to you. And we'll go to more of your calls. We'll go next to Catherine. Catherine, join us.
Hello. I have a very specific question about from exactly which point to which point can you take a mileage deduction. Specifically, I end up driving about 10 or 12 different places a day, and I want to know, do I take the deduction from my home to the first place, or can I only take it after that? And can I take it from the last place I go to my home, or is that not on? Is that not okay?
Robert Kaplan.
Assuming you're an independent contractor, because employee business expenses are pretty well gone, you would, if you go to the office at all, you would take your total mileage for the day and subtract out your normal commute.
Right.
If you never go to the office, you can take all your mileage.
Answers your question, I believe. Thank you, Catherine. Good to hear.
Generally, commuting expenses aren't deductible, general rule.
Here's Avi. Avi is our next caller. Good morning. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. I was just wondering where one can start filing back taxes on a freelance work. What's the process, and where do I start filing?
Yeah, what does he do about back tax filing, Rafael Tolino?
You can go back and find the form in the year and file it and pay it, depending on the situation you're in. But you're encouraged to do so for each year that you haven't filed if you have a balance due. Usually what happens there is if that's the case, you're going to get a letter saying, hey, we miss you. What's going on here? But certainly going back to the year, and filing, and you can find that form back, your prior year forms at IRS.gov to do that.
And thank you, Avi, for the call. And some questions coming in by email. Let me go to this one. Robert Kaplan, you were quite informed before about foreign taxes. See if you can handle this one from Gary, who says, we inherited a residential flat and a commercial unit in Taiwan. We've paid all taxes in Taiwan. We are receiving rental income. How do we include this in our taxes here? And is there a foreign tax credit associated with this?
Yeah, even though you're getting foreign rental income, you're supposed to report that on your U.S. return. There's a longer depreciation period. I think it's 40 years. But you report it as it was a U.S. rental property. It doesn't qualify for this qualified business income because it's not in the U.S. And basically, if you inherited it, you would take the date of death value and start depreciating a portion of that. So you just treat it like a regular U.S. rental property with a few variations.
Aubrey Hone?
There's also you have to report it for an inheritance or a foreign gift on a specific form if the value is over $100,000, and there's very hefty fines for not filing this form. It's form 3520. So you'll want to make sure you understand whether you're required to file that form and get it filed if you need to, because it's very expensive to miss that.
Aubrey Hone, let me go another question from a listener named Robert, who says, I received a large state tax refund in 2018 for my 2014 taxes. Can I change to the accrual accounting method to put those tax refunds into a prior year?
if you deducted the that's a good question.
I read a statistic that there's something like 100 accrual basis individuals in the United States.
That's it. 100. Yeah. These questions do come up, though, don't they?
Yeah.
Well, any more responses to that, or otherwise I'll just go out.
I think for that alone, I would not change to accrual basis. I think you're opening a can of worms.
I think that's what I'm hearing in the subtext here. Let me get another caller on in the meantime. Rose, that's you. Hi, you're on.
Hi. So I had a quick question. I got married end of last year.
Congratulations.
And I was in Maryland. Oh, thank you. And I was a Maryland resident, and my husband is a California resident. So my first question would be, would it be better to file jointly or married separately? I mean, file it separately. And the second question is, if we were to file it jointly, what would be the easiest way to go about doing that?
Okay, we'll defer again to you, Rafael Talena.
Well, married filing joint and married filing separate are the two choices you have. Generally speaking, married filing joint is a lot more beneficial in terms of the laws and what they provide you when you file a return. Married filing separate is an option, and some folks do use that, but you might want to run the numbers depending on things. For example, I have heard stories where one spouse has a lot of debt, and they get married, so the separate choice might be better for something like that. But generally, it's married filing joint would be the choice off the top. And then how to do it, you can do it depending on what your taxes are. You can do it yourself, go to a tax professional. At this point, you might take an extension, which gives you 6 months to file the return through mid-October. But if you have a balance due, you still have to get that in. 80% is the number now with some of the penalty relief we've been offering of that amount due to avoid possible penalties or interest that can accrue.
And Rose, thank you for the call. Again, congratulations on your nuptials. And here's Karen who writes, I'm going to go to you on this, Rafael Talena. She's an Uber driver, and she says, my situation is simple. I have earnings from Uber, car expenses, and covered California. I have no investments. In 2017, my tax was $879. For 2018, a tax consultant told me my tax is $3,000. What could account for this enormous discrepancy?
It might be because she didn't make quarterly estimated payments. We're finding a lot of folks in the shared or gig economy are not taking care of doing that. Taxes are pay as you go, and we understand that as well as what's going on with the new law. So there's some penalty relief there, as I mentioned. But it could be the fact that she's not taking care of paying throughout the year as you normally do.
Yeah, I'm reading a lot about people in the gig economy suffering under these new tax laws. You want to say something about that?
Yeah, it could be.
Please, go ahead.
I'm sorry. It could be that she was subject to self-employment tax in 2018 and not in 17, and that would be a large portion of the tax maybe.
Yep. Good point there.
Anything else to add? We'll go to more calls then. And let's go next to San Jose, and we'll welcome next caller, Alex. Thanks for waiting. You're on.
Hi there. I had a question about rental property depreciation. Is the value for the depreciation at the time I bought it, or does it change annually based on county assessment or another fair market value?
Arion shaking her head. No.
So it's based on the time that you bought it. If you have improvements or other items that you can add and depreciate, those are the adjustments. But you do not adjust the amount that's going to be depreciated based on county assessment or otherwise. It's based on your original cost basis.
And a question from Larry, Robert Kaplan, I'll go to you, regarding health savings accounts. My wife and I are both over 55. We have a family health insurance policy that qualifies us for a health savings account. Can my wife and I both contribute an additional $1,000 catch-up contribution for being over 55, totaling $2,000 combined?
Aubrey, is that right?
Yes, that's right. They both can. Yep.
Okay. And we'll go to more of your calls. Let me thank Alex for his call, and our next caller, also from San Francisco, is Jim. Jim, you're on.
Hey, good morning. I'm just curious whether or not the IRS and the state fall under the same Americans with Disabilities Act. I'm a severe dyslexic. I actually qualify for reading for the blind. I have that bad of a case of dyslexia. And I have called the IRS office to ask them where I take my taxes so that I can have them prepared or have somebody help me through my taxes. And their response each and every time is, you have to pay somebody to do your taxes like everyone else. So I'm just curious whether or not they fall under the Americans for Disabilities Act? And if so, where do I take my taxes?
Can you help Jim here, Rafael Tolino?
Well, yeah. As far as the ADA goes, I don't know the ins and outs of that right off the top. I do want to mention Volunteer Income Tax Assistance, or VITA, that are up and running throughout the Bay Area and everywhere, really. Dozens of sites where you can get free tax preparation depending on your amount of income. It's usually $55,000 or less in simpler returns, but I definitely would refer you to that. You can find VITA site 211, California 211, or irs.gov/V-Victor-ITA, or Volunteer Income Tax Assistance. But off the top, I'll defer to the to Mr. Kaplan and Ms. Hone if they have anything to add to that.
The answer is no. So let me thank the caller and hope everything goes okay for him.
I hope you get that free help that's available that way. That's just my off-the-top thought.
Let me also ask you, though, Rafael Tolino, you know, many people complain about not getting through to the IRS, especially around this time of year. Any thoughts from you on that?
Yeah, irs.gov. That's my thought. Unfortunately, yeah, it's a resource issue. And if you do call the agency, you want to bring your patients with you. If you do get through, you're going to be on hold probably for a little while before that happens, depending on when you call. And if you need to go to an office, by all means, do that. Get face-to-face help, but it's appointment only. So if you need to get help in an office, you want to make an appointment to do that, and that way you can get the help you need. But really, it's irs.gov first for anything, and at least all the task-based tools we have there, you want to go there first.
Another caller joining us, Stephanie. That's you. Good morning.
Oh, hi. So I usually do my taxes with TurboTax because they're fairly simple, but I started graduate school this year, and I received a scholarship that covered about 70% of my tuition. And they paid the rest out of pocket, but it wants to use my scholarship as income, which pushed me into the next tax bracket. And it also said that since my scholarship was so large, I didn't qualify for education credits because it was more money than what I had paid out of pocket. And I now owe about $1,000, and I feel like that might be incorrect.
Aubrey Hone?
Yeah, so a scholarship generally, if it only pays for the tuition, would not be income. So I agree that's not correct. And it may be the way that it's entered, or it may be that you need to visit a tax professional to help you.
Let me just add one thing. Stephanie, check out IRS publication 970. Publication 970 has all the ins and outs for tax benefits for education, and you might read about scholarships, grants, fellowships, that kind of thing, and the tax implications of them there.
And good luck to you, Stephanie. Thank you for your call. Ruth writes, if I moved, and we go to you on this, if I may, Robert Kaplan. If I move to California in mid-November, do I file a California return? I was told I have to live here for 180 days to file a California return. Is that correct?
We would recommend filing both in the state you left and coming into California. You put on record the state that you left, that you've left, so they know that. And then you report your California income after the date you came in here.
And here's Wai Min joining us next. Good morning.
Good morning. Can you hear me well?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I have a question regarding converting primary residence to rental property and then exchanging into another property, living it for 2 years, and then renting it for 2 years and then moving it in as another private residence. What happens when I convert my primary residence to rental property, and then what happens when I convert it from rental property to primary residence? In the new exchange property.
Can you help him through this, Robert Campbell?
Yeah, well, first of all, we recommend that you make it a rental property for quite a period of time to change the stripes from being a principal residence to rental property. We recommend 2 years. Second of all, if you convert back to a principal residence, you would have a portion of your gain be taxable because of the period of time after 2008 that was a rental property would not qualify for the up to $500,000 exclusion for married filing jointly. So you'd have to pay tax on a portion of it. So you don't get your cake and eat it, too.
Good luck to you, Wai Min, and thank you for your call. And on we go to another caller, and that's you, Jackie. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi. Listen, I have a probably silly question, but I've been teaching for almost 30 years, and I retired 2 years ago. And I tried going on TurboTax to do a short form, and I couldn't. So they kind of messed things up. Now, this year, I just want to do, all I have is retirement and Social Security. I just want to do a short form and get it filed. Can you tell me where to go or the best way to do that?
Aubrey Dunn? Well,
there's not a short form anymore. So the the 1040 EZ and 1040
You can't
AF
do a postcard, as we established at the beginning of this program.
Yeah, the only option is to do the regular form 1040.
Yeah, that's it.
You may not have a filing requirement. Well, I mean, depending on what your retirement is, but if your income generally is just Social Security, you may not have a filing requirement at all. So you definitely want to check into that, run some numbers, and check into if you need to file to begin with.
Yeah, good advice, and thank you for the call. And then we go to another caller, Charles, joining us. Charles, you're on the air.
Good morning. I have a $300,000 long-term capital loss, which I've taken $3,000 each year for the last 4 or 5 tax years, where I don't really need that $3,000 loss each year applied. And I'm wondering if I may be able to get that back and apply to those $15,000 worth of 5 years of $3,000 against a $1 million capital gain, long-term capital gain. Am I obliged to take that $3,000 each year, and can I get it back?
Robert Kaplan?
Yeah, you have to take the net $3,000 capital loss, but you still have a large capital loss carry forward to 19 future years that you can offset gain with.
That's, I think, the answer. And thank you for the call. Thank you for the question. There's another question from Charlie who says, what the heck is going on with Schedule K-1s? Why are they so complicated? Are there any guides out there? Rafael Tolino.
Not the easiest thing, K-1s. I would defer to the folks in your studio there who do returns on the ground there and does, you know, K-1s, S-Corp, 1120s, 1065s. It's just, this is,
some say it's maddening. Yeah.
I get it. I'm trying to think. I understand the simplification. It would be nice. No question.
Any thoughts from either of you, Aubrey?
K-1s just are complicated and they're messy. And depending on why you have an investment in a partnership, you may some other type of entity that generates a K-1, you may reconsider whether it's worth it. I have a lot of clients who wait for K-1s till April and they come through with, $20 of income on them, and they might not be worth it.
Here's Joanne. Joanne, you're on. Morning.
Hi. AARP has free tax assistance all over the Bay Area, in fact, all over the country. And so I thought maybe you could pass that on to
that's
your listeners.
That's good
I'm
to know.
I'm to my appointment
that's,
now, and I've been doing it for years and years and years. Yeah.
It's wonderful. They're probably the biggest partner we have, AARP, with tax counseling for the elderly and the VITA programs and throughout the country. But many community-based partners, depending on where you live, throughout the country. But AARP is wonderful.
And here's a listener who may who has a question that may arouse some kinds of emotions. Go ahead, Marie. You're on the air.
Hi. I would like to know why people with children get a deduction at all. It's their choice to have children. Having children impacts all sorts of resources. Why should I have to pay for them? Why should they get a deduction?
That's a reasonable question. I don't know if anybody has a full answer to that, but Aubrey Hung?
So I would mention that there's deductions for dependents, which are not just children. Some people deduct their parents. So there's deduction for the fact that you have a dependent that you care for. I don't know that I would say you're paying for them by the fact that they get a deduction. There is a tax credit specific to children, which I couldn't politically tell you why there is that, why that exists. But the deduction itself is specifically related to the fact that you care for a dependent, and that doesn't apply just to children.
I would add one thing just shortly, as an administrative and enforcement agency, what Congress puts out there, we administer and enforce and take care of through the tax code. So why questions are never really easy, but I understand your question.
And again, Rafael Tolino is spokesperson for the IRS for California and Nevada. And here's Tammy who writes, I'm disabled with ALS and I owe $1,200 from 2012 when I cashed out a 401k. I'm now living on less than half of what I used to. If my situation doesn't improve, will this tax expire in 10 years?
So there is a statute of limitations on collections. So depending on when the tax was assessed and then also understanding if anything's happened in the interim that would extend that 10 years, there are things that could have happened that would extend it. But generally, assuming none of those things have happened, then in 10 years, the debt will expire.
Try to get another caller in here, and that's a caller from Santa Clara, Victor, joining us. Victor, you're on the air.
Hi, my name is Vikram. I'm calling in response to a response I think the IRS person gave to another caller. If the IRS in any way recommends that everybody has to use a third-party software and pay someone else about $100 to get their taxes done every year, why can't the government? It sounds like some sort of conspiracy where the government is propping up third-party companies for them to get money just to do a really complicated tax filing. Why shouldn't the government, after so many years, at least have their own filing system or software, which they should obviously provide for free, so that they can take money from people? At least they should have people file their taxes for free when they're taking money from them anyway.
Well, this is a question for a whole other hour separately, I think. Quick
understood.
Response from you, Rafael Delino.
Well, yeah, we partnership with tax software companies to do that. And as I understand the lobby and the business part of that and the political part of that is way above my pay grade, if you will. But it has been offered that you just pay directly to IRS and IRS have the software. But I haven't heard anything that's going to change that anytime soon.
Well, this is not above your pay grade, and this is a good place to end. Michael asks, I have a large unpaid tax, and I'm mailing a check to pay for it. If it's postmarked by April 15th, is it considered on time by the IRS?
Generally, yes.
Okay. Good positive note to end on. Thank you, Rafael Delino, for spending this time with us.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you, Aubrey Hone.
Thank you.
And thank you, Robert Kaplan.
My pleasure.
And thank you, our listeners. Thank you for all your questions, and hope you get all your tax questions answered before you file, if you haven't filed yet. When we return, we're going to talk about Venezuela. We're going to talk about the resignation of Kirsten Nielsen from head of, Homeland Security, and she's being replaced. Stay tuned. That's all up ahead. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis. On view through April 14th, Blue and Yellow Corridor, an iconic work by Bruce Nauman, realized on the very grounds where the artist conceived it.